exploring policy interventions to reduce food insecurity in Canada. You can read more about Proof and listen to our complete conversation with Valerie Tarasuk at greenplanetmonitor.net. Prior to his historic victory in New York City mayoralty elections last November, his name was barely known. Zohran Mamdani is the first South Asian and the first Muslim to be elected mayor of the United States' most populous city. He's also the first democratic socialist. In the very first line of his acceptance speech, Mamdani tipped his hat to America's most illustrious socialist, Eugene Debs. "The sun may have set over our city this evening," Mamdani declared to huge applause last November 4th, "but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity." How many of Mamdani's supporters or the New Yorkers who voted for him last November actually knew who Eugene Debs was? Few, for sure. Eugene Debs was one of America's great union leaders and radicals. In contrast to late 19th, early 20th century labor leaders like Samuel Gompers, the founder of the American Federation of Labor, Eugene Debs was a man of the left with a distinctive class-based analysis. He was an anti-capitalist, a socialist, and a fierce social radical. Debs believed in political action. He marched with Susan B. Anthony, America's trailblazing women's rights activist. Emma Goldman was a friend of Debs. Debs opposed the First World War and was jailed for his position. He ran for president 3 times in the early 20th century and founded America's Democratic Socialist Party. To learn more about Eugene Debs, the GPM reached out to Sean Goody. Goody is the author of a brand new biography of Eugene Debs, due to be published on the 100th anniversary of Debs' death this coming October. Sean Goody spoke to us from a cubicle in a New York City public library. The connection is a bit weak and there's a bit of noise. You've been working on this book for like 5 years and suddenly Zohran Mamdani mentions Eugene Debs at the very beginning of his acceptance speech. How did you respond? How did you react to that? Did you jump out of your seat?
Well, I was at one of the, I live in New York now, and I was at one of the watch parties, and one of my friends actually was taking photos at the watch party and captured my reaction. And I was just, we were watching his victory speech up on a projector, and I felt like I was in a fugue state or something. Like I was, it literally did seem like I was dreaming. Like I have dreams like this. And, but you know, it's also like, you know, this is the political movement that Zohran comes out of. It's the political lineage he's very much a part of. So it's not necessarily the fact that he draws inspiration from someone like Debs, but it does. It was pretty remarkable to see him signaling right away, literally in the first paragraph, that this is who he was and he wasn't, you know, going to make an apology for it. Yeah, so who is Eugene Debs?
Yeah, who is Eugene Debs lives on, but who was Eugene Debs?
Right. So he was a labor leader and socialist presidential candidate, one of the best orators of his day. He was born in 1855 in Terre Haute, Indiana. He got involved in the trade union movement pretty early. He went to work as a locomotive fireman, which is back then was like shoveling coal into the engines of trains to keep them running. So he did that, and then he got involved very quickly in the union movement. His union, which was a craft union of locomotive firemen, and all the other three brotherhoods were all fairly conservative and kind of inward looking. They kind of wanted to get what was best for them, and they didn't really look out for, even some of the other lower skilled railroad workers, they didn't really see themselves as having any sort of kinship or solidarity with them.
And there were all these different craft unions. I want to ask you about the difference between a craft union back then and an industrial union, but there were craft unions for conductors, for firemen, for switchmen, for brakemen. The porters were another story. Most of the porters, I guess, were black, but it was very divided.
Very divided, and all of the they call them maintenance of way workers, the people that would repair the tracks and cut sort of the work of like common laborers. They were also kind of outside the bounds of these brotherhoods. So yeah, the difference between a craft union and an industrial union is that craft unions organize on skill level. It's kind of a way to sort of divide up the workforce, and that's sort of how it's organized, rather than industrial workers, which organizes, say, like an entire plant or industry. So it's bringing worker industrial workers, industrial unions sort of bring workers together, whereas craft unions kind of divide them up. And so the union movement at the time was very much dominated by craft unions. You had your carpenters, you had like you said, your conductors, your brakemen, and they all were sort of looking out for themselves and not really part of a broader labor movement that was kind of built on solidarity. And so that's sort of where Debs comes out of initially, and he's kind of all right with this, partly because it's only the only thing he knows.
And the craft unions at the time, they opposed strikes. They didn't think that strike action was a good thing, and they didn't think political action was a good thing.
Right. Yeah, it was a very defensive kind of unionism that you try to show your skill to the employer, and then on that basis, sort of hope that they would, give you your higher wages if you kind of showed that you were a respectable worker. And it wasn't really based on kind of flexing strike muscles or really like banding together with other workers. And they would have these at the time. Craft unions, like the brotherhoods, were almost like fraternal organizations more than unions. I mean, they would have these kind of elaborate ceremonies with all this pomp and circumstance. They would have, secret passwords, and so it was, this was also a time when fraternal organizations were very strong in the United States. They were almost, the craft unions were almost more like that than the kind of modern union that we would think of today. And so yeah, just to bring the story back to Debs, he was kind of okay with this, and it was only a bit later on when he and he's still involved in the labor movement. He becomes an officer of the BLF, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, and he starts to be involved in different strikes. And there's a couple strikes in particular, the first of which is this sort of regional strike called the Burlington Strike, which was a strike mostly in Illinois and in Iowa and in some other parts of the Midwest. But it was a major strike for Debs, and he sort of saw the limits of craft unions in that way in the strike, because there's all this sort of division within. If you want to wage an effective strike, you have to have all sorts of workers on board, and even like high skilled workers need the solidarity of other workers if they're going to wage an effective strike. And so when this happens, and the employers are bringing in strike breakers and trying to weaken the strike, Debs is basically like, man, this really isn't working out so well. And so
And even Debs's analysis here was interesting, and I'm quoting here from Ray Ginger. I mean, his 1949 book, The Bending Cross, and this is Debs being quoted. Let it be borne in mind that if the railroad companies can secure men to handle their trains, they have that right. Our men have the right to quit, but their right ends there. Other men have the right to take their places, whatever the opinion of the propriety of so doing may be.
So yeah, he's not. Even when he starts to move, you could say he starts to move to the left, beginning with the Burlington strike, but he's still very moderate. He still does see as like the employer has these like kind of inviolable rights. But you know, capital isn't like oppressing labor in any sort of way. It's just like they have the capital. Labor workers have their labor to sell, and in this sort of almost cooperative relationship, you know, they can produce things. There's even these like paeans that Debs has to like the power of the railroad and stuff. And the idea that like workers are being exploited in any sense is like very much foreign to him at this point. That only starts to change with the Pullman strike.
The Pullman strike
Yeah.
in 1897 or 1898?
1894.
1894, right. And that was a huge strike. There was like 100,000 men went out on strike.
Massive, massive strike. A strike that's like difficult to comprehend today.
Tell me about Pullman. Who was Pullman and what was this strike all about?
Pullman was George Pullman. He was the entrepreneur that started this sleeping car company. And he had a company town outside of Chicago called Pullman. And the town was, you know, it was a company town, so it was completely dominated by the employer. All the land was owned by the company. The workers would be getting paid in company scrip, where the, and they would shop at company stores. Every building in town was owned by the employer. It was a kind of paternalistic sort of capitalism. It was like, we're going to provide this environment for workers to live and thrive in, but they're not, there's not going to be any kind of any sort of pretense of like democracy or anything, or any sense that like workers actually have a voice in constructing this community. Like, we're going to give them the things that they need, and if they don't like it, then tough, basically. You know, the wages were quite bad. There was lots of injuries, and so workers ended up like going on organizing, going on strike. So that was the origin of it, but it really exploded. Debs's union, the American Railway Union, got involved, and it quickly becomes this massive strike, as you mentioned, 100,000 workers, a nationwide strike, not just of, you know, this relatively small group of Pullman workers, but actually all sorts of railroad workers, from, you know, conductors and engineers to switchmen to repairmen to like workers across the country, railroad workers across the country.
So it was the first large-scale industrial strike in the United States.
Yes, it was. And this because the country was so dependent on railroad travel for shipping goods and just for passenger rail as well, this like basically it shut down huge swaths of the country. It showed pretty clearly, and Debs was very moved by this, like the strength that workers actually have when they do band together and do put aside their differences. The strength that they have is enormous.
But it was crushed.
But it was crushed. It was crushed. And that radicalized Debs. He'd already been moving to the left, but this was a real central pivot point, I think, in his life. It showed both, on one hand, the power of solidarity. This moves him deeply. And then on the other side of that, you have just the tremendous organized power of business and government kind of working hand in hand. And he's appalled by this. He ends up getting thrown in jail for his involvement, his leadership in the strike. So that, you know, that's another sort of way to radicalize someone, throw them in jail at this kind of in this sort of crucible moment. That sort of confluence of things is what really pushes him to the left, and he emerges from jail essentially as a, not a socialist yet, but a kind of labor populist. And then by 1897, after the election, he pronounces himself a socialist and is pretty immediately the most prominent socialist in the country because the Pullman strike was such a big deal.
Tell me about the conflict between Eugene Debs and Samuel Gompers. Like when I was in high school, I remember years ago in the United States, in the New York City area, I used to learn about Samuel Gompers, and he was like one of the founding members of the American trade union movement. founded the American Federation of Labor. But Gompers and Debs had a difficult relationship, and Gompers opposed the American Railway Union and he opposed the Pullman strike. Tell me about Eugene Debs versus Samuel Gompers. Like, Gompers was the establishment industrial union guy, wasn't he?
He was, the craft union movement was, or the trade union movement, which was dominated by the craft unions, was bigger at that point. The labor movement was bigger than it was a few decades earlier, but it had some of the same characteristics that we were talking about earlier. Quite narrow and focused on high skilled workers, leaving out lots of lower skilled workers, also the new immigrants from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, also women, also African Americans. So it was Gompers' movement was defensive. It was focused on trying to win better wages for a select group of workers. It was kind of a kind of trade unionism that was anathema to Debs. His unionism was industrial unionism. It was trying to bridge the enormous kind of differences within the working class in America. I mean, this is the most kind of diverse, heterogeneous working class in the world in a lot of ways, and it was also the country with arguably the most powerful business class. And so, put those two things together, it was this extraordinary task of trying to bring people together across divisions while facing just the extraordinary pressure of business and really like plutocracy working hand in hand.
And I mean, it's interesting, back then you think about the late 19th century, the Gilded Age, and the late 19th century, when these huge corporate, like, this is long ago, when huge corporations held unchallenged power in the United States, and, you know, titans of industry were in tight alliance with elected leaders and the American cabinet. I mean, it's not like this anymore, right? I'm being a little ironic here, where the cabinet, American cabinet in 1898 was totally dominated by corporatists and titans of industry, and, you know, the police and the military would come out to defend the rights of the capitalist class. So things have really changed, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the power of capital wasn't really challenged in a fundamental way until the New Deal. So all through Debs' life, he died in 1926. All through Debs' life, what you're talking about was reality. It was really an oligarchic system where, you know, workers' basic rights, to right to organize, to strike, even to have, you know, an effective political voice, was very much neutered. And you know, he was trying to change that. And in many ways, he was a great kind of small D Democrat. He thought that American society was dominated by corporate titans and robber barons. And he thought that ordinary people didn't have enough power in society and didn't have enough control over their lives. And he wanted a sort of democratic revolution to change that, which is, you know, what his own politics and what his Socialist Party was trying to do.
And I mean, he eventually came to a class consciousness, to a very explicit, well-pronounced and articulated class consciousness. He read Marx, I presume, and he was a friend of Emma Goldman, and he got along reasonably well with the Wobblies, the IWW, and Bill Haywood. But I mean, the anarchists were another story. He was very much opposed to violence. But he came to this class consciousness. He communicated with Lenin.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, he kind of melded a lot of different sorts of left-wing politics into a pretty potent combination, I think. I mean, he was a Christian socialist. He was a Marxist. he was a great believer in the abolitionist tradition in America. He was also what they called at the time kind of a labor Republican, believing in freedom as non-domination. So he had these range of kind of strains in his own political thought that spoke to like different parts of American politics and in different parts of the working class. I think he was able to really like speak to, you know, Jewish garment workers in on the Lower East Side and tenant farmers in Oklahoma and, you know, brewery workers in Milwaukee and silver miners in Colorado. This, you know, geographically and regionally and ethnically and racially diverse working class in America, he was able to speak to different parts of that quite well.
So the political parties that Eugene Debs was the president of ran. This was the Socialist Party, the Democratic Right. Socialist Party, and the Populist Party.
So he was, I'm not sure if he was actually technically a member of the Populist Party ever, but he supported Jennings Bryan in 1896 when Bryan ran on the Democratic ticket, but was also endorsed by the People's Party, which is the kind of electoral expression of the populist movement. And then there was a few, he supports Bryan in the fall election. Bryan loses, and Debs comes out as a socialist the following New Year's. So New Year's Day, 1897, this letter comes out and Debs pronounces himself a socialist. And then, so there's a couple socialist parties. There's one called the Social Democracy of America and another one called the Social Democratic Party that Debs is kind of also part of in the initial years. And then, but the Socialist Party that we know is formed kind of out of that sort of lineage in 1901. And that's whose ticket Debs runs on several times.
Debs opposed the First World War.
Yes.
And he went to jail for that.
Yes, yes. And there was tremendous repression against the party. You know, a lot of its newspapers, which were a huge part of the party's education effort, those were also in many cases shut down. Debs gives a famous speech in Canton, Ohio, and is, you know, hauled off to jail for that, and yeah, ends up spending 2.5 years in prison.
The First World War, Debs and many others argued, was a conspiracy amongst the rich capitalists and the corporations to kind of make lots of money, arms dealers and arms merchants, and basically the death of international workers in Europe, across Europe and the United States and Russia, to the benefit of blood-sucking capitalists.
Right. Yeah, that was definitely his view. That was the view of the Socialist Party writ large, really. It was not an easy position to take. there was, like I said, there was tremendous repression. People were getting tarred and feathered for opposing the war.
I mean, this was the Red Scare. This was a period of intense oppression against people who opposed capitalism, who proclaimed socialism and communism and Marxism, and united with, you know, the Bolsheviks in opposition to American and European capitalism's war on people.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Debs was very much supportive of the Russian Revolution, as were most in the party, but he had trouble with certain aspects of the Soviet Union as it went along, for sure. So, you know, he spent 2.5 years in jail, and it's probably what really killed him too. You know, he had health problems through his life just because of the pace of speaking and work. He was never a healthy man, you could say. The drinking probably didn't help either. but he probably could have lived a bit longer if he hadn't been sent off to jail, because that's really, you know, the people that knew him the best said that's what really killed him. And he had about 4 or 5 years left in his life after that.
Okay, so he ran for president on a number of occasions. In which presidential campaigns did Eugene Debs run for president, and for which parties?
Well, the Socialist Party was four of those. He basically ran every single election from 1900 to 1920, with the exception of 1916, when he ran for Congress, actually, from his home seat in Indiana. But yeah, he was the Socialist Party's kind of perennial presidential candidate. His highest percentage was in 1912, which was also when the party was at its peak in terms of elected officials, to some extent influence in the labor movement as well. That was the kind of like golden age of the Socialist Party for really from 1909 to like 1912, 13 was when the party was at its strongest in some ways. So he won 6% of the vote that year, which was the highest vote total he had. And then in 1920, when he was running from prison, he got over 1 million votes.
When is your book coming out, Sean Goody? And what's its title? Its working title, and most importantly, what does it add to scholarship about Eugene Debs?
Yeah, so it's coming out next October 2026. The title is American Socialist.
And that'll be the 100th anniversary of Debs' death.
That's right. Yeah, he died October 20th, 1926. So 100-year anniversary next fall. Yeah, so the book is called American Socialist, The Life and Times of Eugene Debs. I mean, the biggest thing is it's for a new generation. There hasn't been any Debs book in many decades at this point. Any Debs biography. The last one, but not the last major one, was one, a very, very good biography by Nick Salvatore that came out in the early 80s. And then the Ray Ginger one, which is also very good, that came out in the late 40s, as you mentioned. So really, there hasn't been any sort of book in many years. I'm very much a part of this kind of generation. I'm in my mid-30s and part of the millennial socialists, as they say. And so this is a time when socialist politics in America haven't been as strong as they have in, you know, many, many decades. So.
And Joel Brooks, I might add, on top of Zohran Mamdani mentioning Debs in his victory speech not too long ago.
Yeah.
Joel Brooks and Jake Efros, a pair of democratic socialists, have won seats on the Jersey City Council in New Jersey, adding to the hope that socialism has a future. And here at the end of Ginger's book, it's published in 1949, he quotes Debs, this quote, no, socialism will never die. It is inevitable. We may retard or impede its progress through our political organization, but the inevitable cannot die.
That was certainly the spirit of the time. It was a kind of like, old school kind of Marxist certainty in the inevitability of socialism. I think most socialists don't believe that anymore. At least I don't. And I think most people don't. But I do think at the very least, the power of democratic socialism and Debs's ideas too certainly have not died and are certainly quite relevant to our own present with, you know, authoritarianism and climate crisis. And we're living in our own gilded age. And so certainly someone like Debs is, I think, has a lot to offer.
Sean Goody, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sean Goody is a former staff writer for Jacobin magazine. Sean's brand new book, American Socialist, The Life and Times of Eugene Debs, will be released by Simon & Schuster in October 2026. Listen to my complete conversation with Sean Goody at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net and cfmu.ca. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, Well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.